This is a production of Cornell University.
Let's get started. I'd like to call this meeting of the University Assembly to order. It's 4:32, according to my clock, on May 5th, 2020. Can we call the roll, please?
Yes, hi. Joseph Anderson?
Yeah.
Andy Barrientos Gomez?
I'm here.
Christopher Barth?
Here.
Richard Bensel?
Here.
Uche Chukwukere?
Here.
Cody Duell?
Here.
Brandon Fortenberry? David Heiner?
Here.
Alex Hong? Robert Howarth?
Here.
Adam Howell? Logan Kenny? Carolyn Levine?
Here.
Gavin Martin?
Here.
Renelle Mensa?
Here.
Deborah Nyakaru? Jeff P?
Here. Also, Logan's here. I think she got you missed her earlier.
Thank you.
So is Debbie. She's on.
Yep, I'm here.
Debbie's here, and Adam Howell is also on.
All right, I will mark you guys down. Pilar Thompson?
Here.
And Charles Van Loon?
Here. Okay, thank you. We have a strong quorum. No issue with that. I want to start outside of the agenda. Chris Barth sent a request that we move forward with his campus circulator resolution in the time we have left in this meeting and next. And I wanted to devote most of the time today to discussing the code, but Chris proposed that we give him a few minutes to remind us about that resolution, and then he will propose that we take the vote by email over the next week, which is fine by me if it's fine with the assembly. So if people will allow that to proceed, Chris, why don't you take the floor and remind us of the resolution.
Sure. Hey, everybody. So under new business is actually old business. The campus circulator, which is the idea of on-campus TCAT. A lot of things have changed about public transportation. This is something that came out of the UA Campus Planning Committee and the Campus Infrastructure Committee, which we did also ask for support from the other assemblies, the Student Assembly, the GPSA, and the Employee Assembly. I did offer an amendment to the resolution. I had talked to Joel Molina and sort of asked, like, with all the things that have changed, is this still the right time for just kind of be making these big requests when there are jobs and all sorts of things that are up in the air? You know, there's uncertainty about uncertainty, but it was reassuring to talk to Joel because he said this is one of the most important times for the assemblies to be providing their feedback so that our decision makers can make decisions and that university business is still going forward. So what I would like to do, the core of the resolution is still the same, which was something that was voted and passed by the SA in February. It is listed as in discussion by the GPSA, and maybe Andy would be able to give us an update. Tomorrow we're going to vote on it in the Employee Assembly. And the main change is a change to the abstract, as well as the be it resolved clause, which functionally says, hey, it seems like, here's the exact language, which it is in the box folder, and Pilar put it in there. It says the Cornell campus circulator system should be included in the university's long-term strategic plan post the COVID-19 crisis and related financial issues. It is a general priority and represents what the campus wants and will need in the future. And that is mostly getting rid of the timeline that was sort of arbitrary to begin with. And also kind of respecting that this is still something that's going to be important about bringing campus back online, how people get around and when we do get to come back, which I think we will at some point. So that's kind of the update. So I'll make sure that I send an email to everybody to make sure they have the box location. And then before the close of business of this term, if we do not vote on this resolution, it will expire. So what I would like and hope for everybody to do is reread it, and then in our last assembly meeting at the end of the day, we go ahead and take a vote on it. And thank you for the time today.
Okay, thank you, Chris. I want to keep the discussion this fairly short at the moment. Obviously, if people have comments or questions or concerns, they should be aired. Andy.
Hi, thanks, Bob. Just a really quick update. Chris, the GPSA was able to vote on this electronically. We obviously were not able to add that last resolve clause. I should be able to tally up the votes and send those to you by tonight. So we should be able to know where the GPSA stands on the resolution. However, with that last clause, I can definitely address that when I send it out to the actions list to President Pollack.
Thank you for that, Andy. I would like to see how today's meeting goes in terms of our timing, so we can think about the meeting week from today, which is our last meeting scheduled at the moment, by which we could vote for the code. But it may be that we'll want to put out to an electronic vote. So let me, after today's meeting, take that under consideration with the executive board, unless there are objections from anyone to an electronic vote in the meanwhile. But hearing none, we may do that. Thank you, Chris, both for your hard work on this and for pushing me to bring it back to the agenda today. With that, I'd like to move on to the main agenda item, which is the campus code discussion. And I forwarded to all of you Martha Pollack's message to me as of yesterday. I have not been talking to Martha about it for the last month, but I did send her an email over the weekend suggesting that she and I talk, since several people would like to have considered a longer time than we have. So you saw her response. I concur that we really should try and do our best to finish this off by 1 week from today. That's the last possible day by which the trustees can take it up this spring or summer, is the bottom line. With that, let me turn it over to Joe for a summary of the update and latest edits and the decisions which are before us over the next week. Joe.
Yeah, so thanks, Bob. Thanks, everyone. So last Friday, the CJC met and we made two large changes that affect some of the key sticking points that people were concerned about. The first was a bifurcation of the standard of evidence depending on which kind of procedure you went through. So if you go through an administrative panel, you would utilize the standard of evidence that would be preponderance of the evidence. If you went through a hearing panel, you would utilize a clear and convincing standard of evidence. So there's that. The appeals would also be bifurcated depending on where you're appealing from. So if you're appealing from administrative panel, the appeal would be judged on preponderance of the evidence. So that was the first major change. The second major change was we have allowed there to be exceptions to create a public hearing and the exceptions are more in detail listed in the CJC's version of the code procedures that I sent, but essentially it would allow that if there was a large campus community conversation that could be educational in nature, the hearing could be public, you know, parties agreed that, you know, that the public, if all parties agreed that public hearings would be acceptable, it could be a public hearing, but only in the cases in which I believe the way the exception is written, that there wouldn't be immense interpersonal conflict between the parties. Again, I would refer you to the sections of the CJC code documents that describe it. So those were the two major changes in terms of what was written down. And you have both the substantive version and the procedural version from the CJC that I sent out on Monday. In addition, we have extended public comment until this Friday, so people can continue submitting public comments. However, most of these public comments should be really directed at the UA, and I encourage UA members, you know, to look at these, but, you know, the CJC will also look at these. If there is anything substantial in these public comments that is a game-altering kind of change that needs to be considered, we will meet on Friday if necessary. And lastly, there will be a public forum on Thursday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Essentially, it's a forum where we'll present some big key changes, but mainly look to listen to the community. on what they have to say about things. So there is that in specific from the CJC. In addition, I sent you an email on Monday as well, and I suspect we will get to a formalized presentation of this, but through the Office of the Student Advocate, there was an alternative set of code procedures posted and sent. These were approved by the Student Assembly, and I felt that as facilitator of this process, we should sit down, hear it out, hear these procedures, and allow there to be an alternative version. I felt that it constitutes essentially a large scale public comment. And if we want to consider everything in totality, which is our duty to look at the code in totality, I think that's valid and I think that's important. And so I on Monday invited the OSA to present at today's meeting. And after I finish, I'm sure Bob will let them present to go over their key highlights. So I'll let people consider those as well as the CJC's version. I have no issue with it. I think it's fine. I mean, I don't have a particular stake in that game, to be quite honest with you. I'm just trying to facilitate this process. And I felt like this was the good faith move to make. So there is that. But yeah, that's for us. I'm happy, after presentations to continue answering questions. I see several of my CJC members are here. I can defer to them when needed to present an alternative perspective. In addition, in the Monday email, there was also a memo from the OJA on their thoughts that I included in that email to you all. So feel free to take a look at that if you have further concerns. But I'm happy to entertain questions as we go later into the meeting. I'm happy to talk more. Other than that, I feel, people should consider all the options on the table. They should listen. They should really take everything into consideration. And that's as much as I can provide. I'm at this current moment for everyone. So I hope you all will listen. But I can answer questions later in the meeting about, the stuff and how everything kind of plays itself out.
Okay, Joe, thank you for that. You'd suggested that we have Leal Sterling, I believe, from the Office of Student Advocate, give a short presentation on that. I'm fine with that. Richard has his hand up first, though, so let me recognize Richard.
Well, just a question clarifying on how other CJC members would be able to participate in this meeting if we called upon them.
I can yield to them.
Yeah, I mean, the usual tradition, what I've been trying to suggest to the assembly is that we use the procedure that the assembly has used in running its meetings for the last half dozen years that I've seen them, which is that we hear from those who've previously asked to speak, and we'll do that. Leal's included in that. That we give preference to university assembly members. Those are the people who sit around the table generally. And that when it's appropriate to bring in someone else and there's not some pressing member of the university assembly who wants to talk, that we try to accommodate that. So I'm not suggesting anything other than usual practice. Zoom makes it a little bit different because the tendency is to think that everyone here is actually the same role, and we're not. So I want to give, as I say again, preference to the university assembly members and do exactly what we normally would do. Is that okay with you?
No, that's fine. That's what I want.
Thank you. Leo, are you here?
Yes, hi.
Can you give us just 3 or 4 minutes? Is that okay?
I prepared probably around a 6-minute presentation. I prepared a PowerPoint. Would it be okay if I-
Go for it.
Okay, perfect, thank you.
If someone who is a co-host or host could make her a co-host. Oh, she got it. Perfect.
let's see. Okay. Hi, everyone. So my name is Leal Sterling. I am a junior in the College of Industrial and Labor Relations, an undergraduate student. And I currently serve as the student advocate within the Office of the Student Advocate, which I'll explain a little bit more in a second. And I'm here to present on the Office of the Student Advocate's Student Assembly Resolution number 65, which is observations and recommendations on community standards, and specifically dealing with the procedural aspect of the Code of Conduct. So the Office of the Student Advocate, or as we call it, the OSA, was founded and legitimized by the Student Assembly in the fall of 2019 with a twofold purpose. One is to handle casework from students, and the second is to look at that casework and from that casework recommend university policy recommendations to improve the student experience. So that is how this resolution came about. So the changes that we're addressing within this resolution are as follows: increased diversity and inclusion training, restorative justice procedures, increased student involvement in the disciplinary process, amending the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor, and amending the burden of proof. So with regard to our first recommendation, increased diversity and inclusion training, this came about because the Office of the Student Advocate received numerous cases this year from students that brought about diversity and inclusion issues. So at Cornell, we tend to recognize that students have varying identities which affect differently their college experience. And so we must extend that understanding through to the disciplinary process and understand that different students will experience the disciplinary process differently. And so increased diversity and inclusion training will allow us to best prepare for that. In addition, the reason that we're choosing to address this in our recommendations for the code procedures is because we believe that if this is added as a procedural element, then it is ingrained in the procedures and it's more likely to actually happen. The next element of the resolution is restorative justice procedures. So first and foremost, we are an educational environment. We're a university. And so we should understand that with every misstep, there is really a learning opportunity present. So restorative justice and this idea of restorative justice can be more corrective and a learning opportunity rather than something that is purely disciplinary. So an example that I'd like to bring up, one that I think is fairly common, we've all probably heard of, is a first year student being caught in the dorms with alcohol. And so rather than making the response to that violation of the code something that's purely punitive, there's an opportunity there for the student to be given a learning opportunity through restorative justice by means of personal mediation and the opportunity to co-create a learning plan rather than just a simple punishment. I also think this is so important because it allows us to kind of intersect with other issues like mental health. For instance, if a student is caught drinking in the dorms, we are seeing that right now as a kind of superficial issue, a violation of the code, whereas it might be that there's an underlying issue present, something like previous history of alcohol abuse, alcoholism, or something like a mental health issue that's leading the student to drink. And so having a more empathetic approach might allow students to come forward when that is happening and actually talk with an advisor and address those underlying issues rather than just the superficial violation. In addition, under the current system, a student will be given a written reprimand accompanied with a transcript notation. So I think when we see this, we can understand that this is punitive in nature. It's not restorative. And in most of the cases that we're seeing with the code, it's 66.4% of these cases are freshmen. And that's taken from a report released by the OJA for the year 2018-2019. And so within these recommendations, we work out how to make the approach more restorative, encourage students to come to the table and allow for that growing opportunity when freshmen are first coming to campus. So the next aspect of the resolution is increased student involvement in the disciplinary process, which is really why this resolution is coming about. So in my understanding of these new codes, there's a bifurcation of the code, one for students and one for faculty and staff. And so if the code is only addressing students, then it's so crucial that students and specifically undergraduate students are included in this process that really greatly affects them. And I think within this, it's important that we understand that in looking at the code and the procedures as they currently exist, 96% of respondents in code cases are undergraduate students. If we want to look at the exact numbers, 765 students in the 2018-19 year were undergraduates who went through these procedures, 523 of which were freshmen, compared to only 19 graduates and only 4 faculty and staff. So what we can see there is A, that the code and the procedures are actually predominantly already already affecting undergraduate students, but B, that there's a bit of a learning curve here, and perhaps undergraduate students maybe aren't understanding what it is to violate the code. And so there's an opportunity if undergraduate students are more involved in actually writing the code and these procedures, that undergraduate students will also be able to be involved in educating one another. So in terms of developing educational plans for freshmen, for when they come to campus, to be able to actually understand A, what their rights are under the procedures, but also the code itself and what it means to violate the code. And within all of this, I think there is an important question, which is whether we're trying to encourage students to learn and grow from violations of the code, or if we're trying to demand that they fall in line through punitive action. So we're also recommending amending the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor. So within this resolution, we're recommending that counselors must represent complainants and respondents. And that really goes back to the idea that we're an educational institution. We're not a criminal court. So we want to ensure that students at all levels are really learning to be empathetic. And also we have to remind ourselves that this is a learning environment. And so it's not really the place for law students to be practicing to be criminal defense lawyers, which while they're well-intentioned seems to be the case from the cases that the Office of the Student Advocate is seeing right now. In addition, given that we've addressed that this is not a criminal court, undergraduate and graduate students are actually as qualified as law students to represent and advocate on behalf of their peers, which is another recommendation that you'll see within these recommended procedures. So another element of this is amending the burden of proof. And I think what's really important here is that we acknowledge again that this is not a criminal court, it's a school. So there's no jury and the hearings are quite small. There are five people or there are three people. So changing the burden of proof from clear and convincing to preponderance of the evidence doesn't necessarily have the same effect in a disciplinary process as it would in a criminal court where there's a jury and formal jury proceedings. I will admit that when I started considering this idea, I was a little bit hesitant at first, but I think that what really convinced me is understanding that preponderance of the evidence is the standard that's already used in Greek life and policy 6.4 hearings. And what convinced me further is learning about the new executive rules that Betsy DeVos is proposing, one of which is that Title IX will have to use the same burden of proof as other university procedures. And so if we don't lower the burden of proof in code cases, then policy 6.4 and Title IX cases will have to raise the burden of proof to clear and convincing. And we have the opportunity here in the University Assembly, I really want to emphasize, has the opportunity to clearly state its support for survivors by amending the burden of proof within the code. In addition, I think it's important to emphasize that with the increased restorative justice procedures, that'll mean that fewer cases are actually reaching the hearing board. And the ones that do will already be more severe. The next point I want to make is about companion universities. So some of our companion universities have already adopted similar procedural processes. Some of these universities, as I've listed, include the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Michigan, Brown University, Dartmouth, Princeton, Columbia, and the University of Virginia. And lastly, I just want to note the support from students that Resolution 65 has received. So there's currently a letter circulating from student leaders in the undergraduate community that contains signatures from leaders in Black Students United, leaders in L'Association Latina, leaders in the Arab Student Association, in Greek Life, and in the Professional Fraternity Council. And this last point that I really can't emphasize enough is that this resolution received unanimous support from the Student Assembly. So I think it's really clear that students support these recommendations for the procedural element of the code. And with that said, I really hope that you all will choose to support it. And now I'd be glad to take questions. Thank you all for listening to my presentation and for having me here.
All right, thank you, Leo. We'll actually open up to questions both for you and Joseph at the moment. If people would like to put up their hands. Logan?
Hey, yes, thank you for the presentation. I would first like to just quickly note that the proposed new executive rule is a proposal and has not been put into effect. So it's something that we should strongly take into consideration, that it's not a new executive rule, it's a proposed one. But secondly, I'm yielding my time to JCC, Jimmy Pinchuk, because if we're going to hear from the Office of the Student Advocate, I also think that we should hear from the Judicial Codes Counselors.
Logan, I alone will recognize people. We're not yielding time. We've never done that before in university assembly meetings.
We have actually, and
no, we have not. And as chair, I rule that out of order. If there may be a time or place, but I want to start with the opportunity for university assembly meetings to ask questions of Joe and of Leal, and then we will open it up to others as appropriate. Do any members have questions or comments?
Richard has a question.
In his hand. Go ahead, Richard.
I'm a little bit confused about this proposal. Did it go to the CJC? And if it went to the CJC, what was the discussion there? If it didn't go to the CJC, why didn't it?
So thank you. That's a really great question. So it did not go to the CJC. And the reason that it did not go to the CJC is that our intention here was to bring a purely student perspective on a code of conduct that will only address students. I also want to note that all of the sponsors of this resolution, my co-sponsors, are all the student members of the CJC. So they were very involved throughout this process, but the intention was that the CJC is made up of more than just students, and this was supposed to be a purely student perspective. So thank you for bringing that up.
Chris.
I want to make clear that I was not a sponsor of that resolution. Just to make that clear for everyone.
Thank you. Chris.
Thank you for the presentation. OSA, I think, did a really nice job of putting together all the information and looking at things for a relatively new organization. Great job to you guys and for your thoughtfulness. Joe, I got a procedural thing. You know, as an assembly member, when I'm trying to evaluate how I take everybody's input into consideration, the stuff that's on the public forum comments, the earful that we're going to get on Thursday, undoubtedly, what we got from the CJC, and then the OSA's information. As a member, should I be copy and pasting people's paragraphs into a new draft, or how should I really work with that? Because the OSAs seems to have a very different structure where they call for a director and they don't have the administrative review board. So their work seems to be a little bit different than what the CJC has done.
Yeah, there are substantial differences. And I would say, looking at the public support and looking at public comments, I think there needs to be weight upon those who provided very clear-cut substantive comments that directly, you know, implicate language placed. I would also give deference to people who are currently on campus in the campus constituencies recognized by the UA, that being undergraduate, graduate, and professional students, employees, and faculty. I know that there have been a substantial number of alumni comments. I don't believe that alumni have a place at the university assembly, and that's factually correct. They don't. I think that alumni have other ways of engaging in university governance processes, and that is my personal opinion when it comes to alumni. Perhaps, however, there are some substantial alumni comments that play into the Greek life space that I think do deserve deference when contemplating how you think about Greek life and their involvement in Greek life up to this point. I think that's a really important consideration. I think overall, when considering these documents, there is a process ingrained, there is a process put forward. And there is, you know, the process is very clear cut and dry, like UA has a defined chunk. But I don't think that, I've never been one for immense, you know, clarity on process, but I think you should just, I think, you know, the CJC has put a substantial amount of work in their versions. And I think there is a lot of broad array present there. So I'm not going to say what you should think. I think, you know, it's hard for me to be put in this situation just because of the multiple roles that I hold. So I'm trying to be as neutral as and impartial as possible I can be in this process and provide as much information as I can about the versions and the differences that the versions hold, and, you know, say that and provide as much knowledge that I have and much support that I have for the CJ Cities version and give possibilities there. So I'm in a personally very tricky space, to be quite honest with people. You know, as multiple roles, but I'd say the CJC has gone through its immense process.
Charlie, you're muted.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get my head around standards of evidence. So let me start with Leo. So you had a list of schools, and were they in the same camp, same standard of evidence camp as the proposal, or different?
So actually the schools that I listed, I went through and did an analysis of them for diversity and inclusion procedures, as well as restorative justice approaches, and also undergraduate student involvement as advisors within code procedures, but I didn't actually check for the different codes. And the reason that I did that, and also in response to a point that Logan made earlier, is because of the changing, the evolving situation with the potential new rules. I think that if we're changing the code and the procedures now, then this is the opportunity to, you know, preemptively respond to what might be new rules. It will be, in my opinion, too late to do it after these rules actually are in place and being enforced by the Trump administration. So I just wanted to make that clear. And I appreciate that Logan clarified that they haven't actually been enacted yet.
Okay, thank you. So a week ago, we had a discussion about this. And I don't recall at that time that there was this fork in the road, that in some settings, it was preponderance of evidence, and in other settings, it was clear and convincing. Is that something new that happened during the last week? This might be a question for Joe.
Yeah, that happened at our last CJC meeting this past Friday.
And can you explain the fork in the road? Why in one setting the committee felt that a higher standard was necessary versus the other one?
So the hearing panel includes any potential sanctions that are disciplinary, probation, suspension, and expulsion. Because of the severity of those sanctions, a higher standard of evidence should be utilized in order to ensure due process for the respondent. That was the argument. That was the argument posed, and I think that was the rationale. Anyone in the CJC can correct me, but I think that was the rationale utilized.
Okay. In Barbara's letter, she mentioned that having two different standards in the code itself is confusing. Can we have some comments on that?
Since it is a new change proposed, we haven't received comments on it. So there's that. I think Barb can explain further her rationale as to writing that in the memo. And I think I would yield to Barb on that point as to why she believes that.
Barbara?
Just looking to the chair for...
Yeah, go ahead, Barbara. Thank you.
So I just think inherently trying to work through a code with two different burdens of proof in two different types of settings is more complex and potentially confusing than to have a single burden of proof. Our office also has expressed that if there is going to be that differentiation, you know, suspension and expulsion are one thing. Probation, to me, is not a sanction that is at the level of seriousness that would justify a higher burden of proof in order to put a student on probation.
Okay, thank you for that. I have several hands up, two UA members, two non-UA members. If there are UA members who have not spoken and want to, you know, please do put your hands up. Otherwise, I will start calling on others. I'm going to call on Logan first because she's the highest listed UA member. Logan.
Thank you. So I have two questions for Joe, but first I'd like to just point out, if we're going to call on our judicial administrator, I think that we should also give the JCCs an opportunity to speak if they'd like to, but that's besides the point. I went through all the comments. This is going to just be really quickly. And of the 42 comments, there were 23 people who were against us changing the burden of proof altogether, and only 3 people who wanted the preponderance change. So I think that's something significant to note it. And also the Facebook post from The Sun about our last UA meeting, 6 of the 8 comments directly opposed it as well, with the most popular comment receiving 43 upvotes. So while I agree that a bifurcated system is probably not the best one, I also believe that clear and convincing across the board from our public comments has been spoken about the most and the thing that the community is the most upset about. There have also been 11 people who have told us that the timing issue is inappropriate. Just quickly to ask for Joe, the public hearings, I just want to clarify, is it the chair of the hearing board or the committee at the time who has the decision, or does the OJA also have a say? And then secondly, I saw some comments on free speech concerns while reading through the past 2 days, and one by a member of the UHRB board currently, and I know the CJC didn't have a chance to address those, so I was wondering you were going to.
Yeah, so I will answer the second one as I try to pull up the exact language on your public hearing question. The second one, free speech 100% is ingrained. There is the response, there is the document that we were given on responsible speech and free speech, or whatever the exact title is, I don't have right now. That one was edited at the beginning of the semester a bit, and was edited. And I can say, like, just because there was priority placed upon the substantive code and the procedural code, we weren't able to finalize those edits. But there should be no concern that freedom of speech is not an upheld, you know, principle placed inside of, you know, this process. So I think it was just a, you know, process workflow thing where we had to prioritize 2 larger scale documents. So I want to put that 100%, you know, at ease, and to make sure everyone knows. I am searching my document for public hearing. So on the public hearing part, it is listed in section 5.4. And in a later section as well, when it describes the hearing panel, but in 5.4 in the version I sent to the UA on Monday from the CJC, all hearings shall be private unless A, a respondent notifies OSCCF no later than 2 business days before the hearing and the respondent wishes for a public hearing, and B, the administrative panel chair determines that a public hearing would not result in undue intimidation of the named complainant or the witnesses. So it is the panel chair that does get that final say. The exact procedure, and I'm assuming, this is an assumption, so do not, you know, quote me, but I don't know the exact panel procedures that are utilized. I don't know if Robert's rules or anything like that. So if there is like a motion to overrule the chair, I don't have the knowledge, but it is the panel chair that makes that determination, yes.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
You're welcome.
I'm going to call on Richard and then Risa after that. Richard.
Just a note. I was going to have note that Risa was going to speak, and she.
Yeah, no, I'll call her next. Thank you.
Yeah, she'll do a better job than I will. Okay. I just want to say that the I don't regard the punishments that the university can inflict on undergraduates as not the equivalent in seriousness or gravity with criminal prosecutions. We have seen a number of cases that really egregious cases of prosecutions by the University of undergraduates that have not only denied their rights, but actually inflicted great harm. This is a, so I really dissent from that viewpoint. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Risa, thanks for your patience.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for calling on me. Just a couple of things. One is procedural. Richard Bensel asked whether the Office of the Student Advocate made any comments to the CJC, and the answer was no. And so I'm really stunned, actually, to be in a hearing where a body like an organization that could have come to the CJC is given the floor to provide comments to the whole, to the UA. I mean, it seems inappropriate to me to have it done in that way. The CJC would have been happy to have received the comments. Our CJC meetings were open. People could have come to them and commented. So it seems to me that this really puts a thumb on the scales in a way that privileges the Office of Student Advocate in a way that no other organization is really being able to do. That's apart from whether I agree or disagree with the content. I think some of the content of the suggestions from the Office of Student Advocate, I mean, restorative justice is in the code at this point. I think everybody agrees on that. Increased diversity and inclusion training, that's a good thing. There are always ways in which the transcript notation issue can be addressed less punitively. I think that's a good thing. Seems to me that the real question that anybody has any disagreement on here is the preponderance of evidence or clear and convincing evidence standard. And again, I just think it's an unfair and unwarranted privileging of one group to make that kind of argument. So I really hope that people take that into account when you're thinking about the merits of the arguments. So, I'd also like to weigh in on that standard of proof for a moment. One is that the clear and convincing evidence standard is to say that something's highly probable. So I think that we should all be clear on what it is. It is not beyond any reasonable doubt. It is a much lower standard than the criminal law standard. But it is higher than just more likely than not. More likely than not means that there's a significant amount of evidence that the person should not be found responsible. And it's just an extra amount to make it that sort of 51%, whatever that exactly means. Clear and convincing evidence is something more. It's highly probable. And it goes along with the stakes that students have. I mean, I really think that most students would say that being put on disciplinary probation is quite serious, no matter what the OJA thinks. So from the student standpoint, I think that they feel this is very, very serious. And that's why you have all those public comments in that way. Certainly suspension and expulsion are life-altering kinds of sanctions. They will go with a student forever. They may change the course of the student's educational process, you know, where they go to school, what jobs they get, et cetera, et cetera. And so as a student, it seems to me that it's most fair to say the evidence of responsibility should be clear and convincing. What it means is that the evidence is persuasive enough so that the decision makers are confident in the reliability of the evidence and the persuasiveness of the evidence. And I think we should keep that in mind. It is not an outrageously high standard of proof. And the other thing with that is to keep in mind, most of these hearings will be private. They will not have the due process protections of public hearings that we have in the courts. The hearings also do not use a strict standard of evidence. They use a relaxed standard of evidence. And that's also a lack of due process that you get in the courts. And so it's appropriate to compensate for the relaxed kind of due process provisions that we have evidentially, as well as in terms of most of these being private hearings, where we say we need to be persuaded sufficiently that it's highly probable that somebody is responsible before we impose a sanction on them that could truly be life-altering. That's also the reason for the bifurcation. We could do clear and convincing evidence for everything, but for the administrative panels, given that it would be a written warning or an oral warning, which are not as severe, it seemed commensurate with the kind of sanction that somebody faces at the administrative panel to say that preponderance could be enough. So thanks, I really, can I say, I have a chance to say one other thing on 6.4? I hope you'll bear with me on that.
Another minute.
And that is, as Logan pointed out, Title IX proposed regulations are proposed regulations. We don't know what those will be. I don't think we should make decisions on that basis. Further, I'd also point out that 6.4, of course, dealing with sexual harassment was in the original code. The original code, as it stands now, has clear and convincing evidence as its standard. It was always used that way. It was pulled out of the code and made preponderance. There are many people who I think would, including me, support making that also clear and convincing for all of the reasons that I just talked about, including the other notion of race and racial bias that can really hurt respondents in those kinds of sexual harassment cases. Seems to me to correct for that, we really need to look at clear and convincing. So it's not just one way. If we have it across the board, ultimately, there's a possibility that clear and convincing evidence could be used for 6.4. But I don't think that's the basis for us to make that decision on this code now. So thanks a lot. I appreciate the time.
Okay. Thank you, Risa. Joe, do you want to?
Could I? Yeah, let me just, I mean, on the procedural point, and I think it's, again, I've been very transparent of how I feel like I'm in an awkward place being president of the SA and chair of the CJC. But as president of the SA, our charter does give us formalized authority to disagree with actions of assemblies and object to the actions of assemblies. And the OSA was utilizing that provision within our charter, not of one. And so it is codified within our charter. And so I wouldn't say, and so I want to provide that context so people don't think this is a freewheeling thing that the OSA just went rogue and decided to do. That's not the case. It's Article 3, Section 4, Subsection B gives the student assembly and therefore branches of the student assembly that authority to do this. And you can make your determinations upon that however you wish, but there is a codified authority for that. And I, in an attempt to be a broker between things, I tried to do that. I tried to do my best with navigating the waters, and you know, I don't get paid for this, to be quite honest, as none of us do. So I tried to do my best. And so if people are mad about the procedures and stuff like that, you know, put the blame on me. I want to be as transparent as possible with how I try to do this. It wasn't to be, you know, blah, 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 anything like that, malicious, or if people think it's that, but I don't think anyone thinks it's that, hopefully. So I want to clarify that,
Thank you, Joe. And just, I don't want to express an opinion at all on it, other than to say that I was not aware of this until yesterday. So it's all new to me.
Could I also respond, if that's okay?
Yes, you may.
So I just wanted to explain a little bit of the Office of the Student Advocate's process in going about this. So the reason that we started with this process is because we were receiving casework from students going through the procedural process through the code of conduct, and they were expressing frustration. And the OSA, as Joe mentioned, is a lateral arm of the student assembly. So naturally, when that happened, we went to other members of the student assembly, some of whom sit on the CJC. And it became clear from that that the members of the CJC, you know, were looking to provide increased student perspective on what's happening with the code procedures and the code of conduct in a way that I might describe as frustrated with what's happening on the CJC, which is why it didn't seem natural to then go to the CJC when these undergraduate students on the CJC were involved. So from there, we went to our chair of the student assembly, who is Joe, to ask about the procedural process for this and if there is an opportunity for the student assembly and thus the Office of the Student Advocate to actually actually get involved and make recommendations and proposals. I also just wanted to note in response to an earlier question from Professor Van Loan, my co-sponsor on this resolution, Kat Wong, who is here, messaged me just to inform me that preponderance of the evidence is actually the standard that's used by most university bodies. And we do have actually some numbers on that. So if you'd like, we're able to provide additional information.
Okay, thank you for that. James Pinjak.
Hey everyone, for those of you—
thanks for your patience, by the way.
Of course, don't worry about it. My name is Jimmy Pinjak. I am from the JCC office. Our head JCC couldn't be here today because she has a final. So we weren't shared, or at least I wasn't shared, the student advocate's proposal. So I just wrote down a few thoughts. I think it's, you know, first important to talk about, you know, the things that we probably agree on. Restorative justice is important. And, you know, there are a lot of cases where an undergrad student, a freshman, comes to Cornell and you know, like the student advocate mentions, has some alcohol incident. And in those cases, you know, it's true. You know, we should be worrying about not just having punitive measures, but situations where the person could actually grow. Which is confusing to me that this was in the proposal, because it's something that the JAA has actually already done and does a very good job at. They do mediation in these cases. Students go to basics training. Students, you know, I could tell you that the process is educational. I think we're already in a good spot there. But going, I think, to the substance of the proposal, I'm pretty surprised that someone from the office of this quote unquote student advocate is proposing these measures. It's pretty shocking. I mean, if I went to anyone, and especially being couched in, well, this is what the undergrads want, and this is the student perspective. You know, we work with students, and if I went to a student client, I said, you know, I can give you two choices here. One choice, it's easier for you to get suspended or expelled if you didn't do it with the preponderance standard. Or you could have this other choice where it's clear and convincing evidence. You know, I don't know who would pick that route. If I said, well, on one hand, we can guarantee you a law student advisor who in some situations has actually dealt with clinic work, who has taken professional responsibility classes, or someone who doesn't have this type of training, you know, I don't know too many cases where the student would take that alternative route. And it also, you know, that there was a petition, I think there was a Sun article recently that said that over 300 students, undergrad students, signed a petition calling for greater protections, calling for the JCC to be strong in these meetings, for the JCC to be able to speak up. So this is not a unanimous student position. In fact, I'm a student. Law students who commented on the public forum were students. Where are the students who think that it should be easier to get in trouble with code? Why didn't they publicly comment on the CJC code? So I do find that misleading. And you know, at the end of the day, this is supposed to be educational. But what are we trying to do? We're trying to create a code that gives due process. If we weren't interested in due process, what would this code look like? It would probably be one sentence, and it would say, you will have a faculty member who will hear your story, and then they will decide, and that's it. No standard of proof, no witnesses, no cross-examination, no appeals processes. We've already implicitly decided that we need due process because there is a legitimate concern that a student will be wrongfully accused. And that's not to say anything bad about the JA. I mean, you know, I think that a lot of prosecutors in this country, for instance, are good people, but sometimes the evidence just comes out wrong. Sometimes a police officer in these reports writes down something that's incorrect. And there should be some type of process to make sure that that's reliable. So we've already decided that all students aren't responsible. And that's what I don't understand about the student advocate's presentation. It's implicitly assuming that every student who gets referred to the JA is responsible. And that's just not the case, because not once in the student advocate's presentation did I hear the word due process or strengthening due process. All I heard was we need to make this more educational. If you're a student who's wrongly accused of something and you get sanctioned because of improper due or insubstantial due process, that's education. You may learn something. You may learn that the world can be unfair, and so that's not educational.
Jim, I'm going to cut you off because you've had 4 or 5 minutes, and I think you've made your point, but thank you. Charlie. You're muted.
Muted. Charlie, you're muted.
So let me just defer to someone else because I have this sort of, again, general questions about trying to understand standards of evidence. So let's have a couple of other questions, then I'll come back.
Okay. I'm going to go to Gavin next, Richard, if that's okay, because he hasn't spoken before. You want to speak? Gavin.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you so much. And this is mostly as it relates to the comments that were brought up by you just recently, James. I don't believe the Office of Student Advocate is saying that the process right now is not educational. I think it is more a conversation of, can it be more educational for students? Can it be more informative for students? So I believe that's the first thing. I also believe, I think there is something to be said of the petition that was signed by 300 students, but I also think that there's something to be said of the students who were advocating for that to the petition to be signed, which were largely mock trial students in my group chats that were asking for it to be signed, in which you were a part of mock trial. So it helps me to better understand who is asking for this and who is not asking for this. I also think the last thing to be said is, if students can advocate on students' behalf, it is my, not only my conception, but the students I represent and the students that I ask, that it would be a more educational process. There, undergraduate students are not involved in the law student's code of conduct or their revisal process of the law student's code of conduct. So I guess my question is, in which world should we weigh more the law student's opinions in this matter than the undergraduate students?
Okay, thank you. Uche, and then I'll come back to Richard after that. Uche.
Thank you so much. And yeah, I would really just like to, you know, echo Gavin, but also just make a point that, you know, throughout this discussion, I've been hearing a lot of, like, you know, talk about, like, looking out for minority communities and, you know, worry that this might disproportionately affect minority communities. And I'm a little bit bothered just because, like, I don't think it's appropriate to try and speak for communities that you don't actively represent or you are not a part of. But also on top of the fact that the OSA, you know, in the presentation that Liel just gave, seeing that there are leaders from Black Students United, from La Asociación Latina, from the Multicultural Greek and Fraternal Council, from communities that are most marginalized and most affected by some of these changes, showing their support for the Office of the Student Advocate's revisions to the code, I think speaks worlds to it. I think the fact that, you know, in the past 2 years, we have had zero expulsions and what is it? There are 10 suspensions, 10, excuse me, someone correct me if I'm wrong, 10 direct suspensions of students and even lower numbers. I just think nobody's actually paying attention to the numbers that we actually have on hand and in the record. And I think that it's just, like, again, really disrespectful that, like, you know, the amount of work that Liel, I've seen personally, the Office of Student Advocate has done, even when we talk about the past, or not the past, when the school was shutting down due to COVID-19 and the amount of advocacy and work that the Office of Student Advocate has put in, the amount of trust that undergraduate students put into the OSA, especially seeing as they're 96% of the respondents to that go under any process. I think that this code has, excuse me, the revisions that the OSA has put forth has been very inclusive and in making sure that they're going after the most marginalized communities and getting their thoughts and opinions on this. And I don't think that it's appropriate that we're also looking at the public comments on the assembly page, because they are not representative of, again, undergraduate students who make up 96% of the respondents. So yeah.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm going to go to Richard and then Deborah.
Bob, could you put me at the end of the list? Because I'm going to walk through an example and it might take some time. And if there's
that'd
not
be fine.
Time.
Deborah.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm new to the UA. I've been in shared governance.
on the student assembly side, but this is like a new space for me. So I guess my one question and or concern was in relationship to the sentiment that has been talked about, kind of that I would broadly describe as this new code procedure being like an abuse or an overreach of power, and just kind of where the sentiment of how this system would be like wrongfully, I guess, finding people guilty of breaches of the code of conduct. Because I think it's important to recognize and understand what brought us to this point where we're reviewing the code of conduct in the first place. And I think in my understanding of that situation, it's going back to the, I guess, egregious situations that happened, I think 2 or 3 years ago, where the code was not adequately written to protect students that had been the victims or the complainants of different just wrongs on campus. I think it's important. I want an answer to my question, like what part of the code or the procedure would be an overreach or would potentially harm students? And just a comment on like how, again, back to Utre's point about what kind of communities these are affecting and like if this, I guess, sentiment is actually codified in the rules that were being discussed.
Okay, thank you, and welcome to the assembly. I should have said that at the start. Logan.
Thanks. First off, hi, Deborah, nice to meet you and welcome. I wanted to just go off of what Deborah first said, or last said, I think, which is what brought us here. And what brought us here was really to make a clearer document that was more easy for people to understand and to get rid of ambiguities that were being misconstrued across the board. And we were seeing different decisions with similar cases. And what we ended up doing was something fundamentally different. And that's looking at changes that directly impact students' rights and directly change the whole judicial system. So, I have a few points. One was, why should we listen to law students, which I find a bit offensive. We're training to be advocates. Me personally, I'm training to go into advocacy, to advocate on behalf of people who can't speak for themselves. I've gone through 2 years of studying. I read case books and case law all the time. Same with Jimmy, he's one of my peers, and the JCC's office, they're the students that are representing you. They are the ones who know the code inside and out and have seen the ways that it has hurt students. So the reason I think that law students should be taken seriously is because we genuinely care about due process. It's ingrained in us from our first semester with constitutional law, and we care. Another thing that concerns me is not being able to speak for marginalized communities. I want to speak for marginalized communities because I see lowering our burden of proof as a way to lead us directly towards wrongful convictions. If you grow up in a community where you are at a disadvantage educationally, or if your race comes into play, or if you don't even, not even being marginalized, but if it's a person who lacks confidence and is looking at the ground and the standard is to find you 51% guilty, bias is just going to infiltrate that room. And we already have bias in the system, bias in the world, and it's a terrible thing, but it's true, whether it's implicit or blatant. And lowering a burden to make it easier to convict people, I just will never understand how I am hearing students say that this is a more educational process, because we are moving towards a punitive process. And lastly, not an attack on you, Joe, but Joe, it's very hard when you speak as student assembly president and CJC chair, and we all know what your opinions are as SA president and the people that you are bringing in, members of your constituent group, and that you're working with the preponderance of the evidence. It's just not an unbiased position, and it's very hard to take that seriously and to feel like the CJC is being adequately represented and the students who want the clear and convincing standard are being adequately represented, because I do believe the GPSA and other constituent groups should have been asked to give proposals if there was going to be a proposal given. not just the student assembly.
So I want to respond to that because I think that's just very, you know, assumptuous about my position. I really resent that. I don't appreciate that at all, Logan. I mean, I took this position wanting to change the code of conduct at the beginning of this semester, and I wanted to make it work so that this thing could work for students. So that is very assumptuous about my position, presumptuous about my position. I'm genuinely very hurt by that because I put in so much work into this to try to get this done. And that hurts to my core. And if you think that's true of me, then I truly have done a poor job of doing the job that I was supposed to do. And I hope that no one actually believes that. And if they do, I want to engage in, I just don't even think that that's, you know, so right. So I that hurts me, Logan, it truly does. But secondly, I think you answered Debbie's question wrong. The reason why this code process ever decided to change is because Black students, over 300 in mass, came to the university assembly meeting protesting the conditions that Black students face on this college campus, and it created a task force on campus climate that recommended these changes. I was the one who made the motion, to investigate changing the code to actually respond to students' concerns. So I think we cannot be erasing the fact that Black students on this campus did that. So I think that's what we need to be centering, is that there was a, you know, mass campus outcry to this. And I think we should be interrogating why we aren't listening to those student communities anymore. So I want to drive to that point. But Logan, I mean, I'm just so, it deeply, deeply hurts me that you would suggest something like that. And, you know, God, if that's what it is, then
I'm gonna cut you off, Joe. I appreciate your feelings totally, but I want everyone to calm down a little bit. We have just over 20 minutes left. I believe everyone involved has good motives here. I really do. And we have some real differences of agreement as to where we are going with it. But I don't think we should be making it personal in the least. We should be striving to come to a consensus on where we have those differences. And with that, I'm going to turn to members who have not spoken first, and then we'll come back around. So Caroline, please.
I'm relative newcomer to the UA and to the whole question of the code of conduct. I'm speaking from a level of ignorance. I'm also not a lawyer or a law student. Speaking from a level of ignorance that I want to precede what it is that I'm going to say. But from my reading of the news and being a feminist for I don't know how long, more longer than I can remember, it seems to me that we have two different constituencies not quite being named, but on the minds of both sides of this debate, and both sides of the debate have a right to be concerned about those constituencies, but they are different, and they are, that is to say, the those who are accused, you know, that the burden of proof should not be lowered because we're worried about protecting the people who might be accused. But universities, the law, the legal system has such a terrible, terrible record of ever prosecuting sexual harassment and assault cases, ever finding the perpetrators. And we know that there are perpetrators on all of these college campuses. So those of us who've watched this from the sidelines think actually it's important to amplify the voices of those, at least so that they're heard more than they are now, of those whose lives are ruined by sexual assault, especially by rape. So I'm feeling like, yes, everybody is well-intentioned, but we have two basically unresolvable positions, both of which have moral authority to them. And that's where I would sit. And so it's not a personal, I don't even hear, both the personal and the procedural stuff seems wrong to me. We have a petition, but then we also have students who haven't spoken via petition. We'd have to have an actual referendum if we wanted to know what it is that undergraduates think. I'm not sure that that's even going to resolve this core problem, which is which population is the one that most vulnerable and needs to be protected most. And of course we have strong values and opinions that come from different places on that. So that's all I'll say for the moment.
Thank you for that, Carol.
Bob, can I just Can I actually let Logan respond to my thing? Because I think it is warranted to have
okay.
her respond to my comments.
But I would like to get to the substantive issue and move it beyond the...
Yeah.
We're all tired, right?
Yeah.
Logan.
Thank you for recognizing me. Yeah, I think it's important to let me to respond because I think that my comment was taken in a way I absolutely did not intend it, because I am so proud and grateful for everything that Joe did, taking on such a huge burden. And my point was not to say that Joe is an entirely unbiased working behind the scenes person, but rather to say that when we see members of the SA come in that are so adamantly opposed to certain things, but we're not hearing from other groups, it's sometimes hard to distinguish between his role as SA president and CJC chair, which he also said. So I wanted to apologize that it came off that way, because I didn't want to attack Joe or have anyone feel like I was attacking Joe. And if it wasn't for Joe, we wouldn't be here right now. So I just wanted to set the record straight that I wasn't trying to say that, and also that I understand where the code came from and that Joe has been instrumental in moving that along, and we're all grateful for him. But I think it was very important to let me to respond to that, because I would never want the entire committee to have that impression, and I think it would be wrong to leave with that.
Good, yeah, and I just want to make sure that I will be as transparent as I possibly can in alternating the roles, as I've attempted to do. So if people want clarification on where what role I might be speaking from, I will try my best to do that, because that is, if as I've mentioned several times, it's very awkward for me.
Charlie.
Just two specific questions, and it may go back a couple of speakers. So one is, Cornell would be a kind of an outlier here with the going for clear and convincing. I want to know, is there something special about us, or is this some kind of sign of leadership? So that's one question. And the second one is, again, could someone explain again, there are going to be changes at the federal level, and can you explain like before and after at the federal level, and why we should take a step this way or that way to ward off something, whatever it is. So that went by me too fast. I'd like someone to clarify that.
Okay, thank you for that. Richard, do you want to speak now? You're the sole UA person, your hand up still.
Well, I have a longer example, but I don't think I'm going to press it. We're going to do this again next week, right? So
we hopefully will make a final decision next week.
No, I understand. But at that point, I do want to walk through an example that will take some time. I do want to say a couple of things, though. I think Carolyn's point is a good one. It is really, really difficult to figure out what the right position is. In doing this, the campus code is a good part of determining the kind of community we want to be. And I think at the very heart of this problem of a preponderance of clear and convincing has to do with that. On the one hand, preponderance emphasizes uncertainty, majority, judgment, passions. I do think Reese is right about this, passions and so forth. Clear and convincing emphasizes individual moral responsibility. And those are two contesting things. In a university, the individual responsibility, the moral responsibility for reaching a judgment on whether, you know, someone's guilty or not of some kind of offense, that is really impressed upon someone participating in this process when it's clear and convincing. Clear and convincing to me. Preponderance is often an appeal to majorities. Well, it appears to most of my peers that X is the case. Those are two different things. I tend, you probably know this, I tend on the individual moral responsibility in taking stands and so forth and so on. I understand intellectually, though emotionally I cannot figure it out, why communities have to have a group judgment, consensus, and so forth. It's just not very sympathetic to it. What I am not sympathetic to, though, is that the preponderance of the evidence might be resting on conformity to other schools or to best practices, or that it might be justified in terms of efficiency because it's easier to conduct cases in that way. The education element, boy, I don't understand that one at all. Both of these are educational. It doesn't matter whether it's clear and convincing or it's preponderance of evidence. So I think that one's off the table for me. But conformity and efficiency just do not weigh in the scale for me as equal to the chances, in fact, in some cases, the probability of convicting someone of an offense, and it is convicting because these consequences are extremely serious for students, of convicting someone unjustly. But I'll save the rest of it for next time.
Okay, thank you. We have somewhat less than 15 minutes left, which is plenty of time in one way, but it's not in another. I have four hands up. I'm gonna again give preference to UA members. I'm gonna ask that everyone though try to speak for just a minute or so, and so we can get as many people in as possible. So, Andy.
Thanks, Bob. This might seem a little tangential, but I think it's also related to the conversation when it comes to student input. There is a time conflict for the open forum on Thursday when it comes to graduate professional students, because at the same time, there's gonna be a town hall for the reactivation of teaching committee. So I just wanna address that and maybe consider, I know that there's an option to submit online feedback, but maybe that hasn't been the best option in the past. So I just wanted to address that. The participation from graduate professional students might be limited because of that time conflict. Thank you.
Thank you, I wasn't aware of the conflict. Thanks. And again, if we could just have one or two minutes each, Jimmy.
Everyone, yeah, just to briefly go. So to Carolyn's question, I think, yeah, I mean, this is kind of the big issue when we're deciding standards of proof, you know, who has what to lose, who has what to gain. And I think, yeah, in the case where sexual assault or sexual harassment is on the table, the potential of a victim to have to run into someone who assaulted them on campus is scary. But that's, you know, why none of this will ever apply to sexual harassment or sexual assault. This is not 6.4. 6.4 is preponderance of evidence. This will not change that. This is everything but academic integrity and 6.4. And then, I think Charles asked about clear and convincing, you know, why go to clear and convincing? We're already at clear and convincing. So this is the status quo. The change would be to go to preponderance of the evidence. So I think if we're going to say, well, why should we have preponderance of the evidence? The question would be, you know, why should we change it to preponderance? Not why should we change it to clear and convincing? And then just one last thing on this preponderance of the evidence. It's not like this is a unanimous verdict decision by a jury where all of the panel members must say, we find this person responsible. This is non-unanimous, which means that forget about preponderance or clear and convincing. It's already easier to find someone responsible to the code of conduct because it's not unanimous, which means if you, on top of having non-unanimity, lower the burden from clear and convincing preponderance of the evidence, then you could have a 3-2 split on a hearing panel with two people think that the person didn't do it, and the other three people think it's about 50.1% sure that it happened. And that could be the difference between someone being at Cornell and getting a job or being expelled, which I think is too grave of a consequence for the burden. Thank you.
Thank you. Risa.
All right, thanks. Just want to make a couple of comments. I appreciate, you know, hearing all the comments, and I think that the comments we just heard from James were, you know, really capturing a lot of the issues. One of the things, I think Cornell is a leader with regard to clear and convincing. It's actually always something I've been really proud of, to say that Cornell actually has a due process standard that take seriously the outcomes, the impact on people's lives from being charged with a violation of the code, particularly, you know, in terms of those serious outcomes. That seems to me to be fair. And I think that the points James made were very good about the majority vote. But I only have a minute, I guess. So let me just mention that I on the process piece, Joe, I took a look at the section you were pointing to that says that, I just lost it again, that if the SA determines by 2/3 vote that the action of another constituency body impacts its constituency, comparable procedures for the reconciliation of the differences will be pursued. I'm assuming that's the provision that you meant. And I took a look also just in this time, the first time I've ever seen it, the full proposal from the that was in front of the student assembly, which is massively, massively different as a model from the one that the CJC has put before you. And so it still seems to me that all the people who would have liked to have used a different model were welcome and could have come before the CJC and made their case, given their positions. This is not the moment, you know, at the 11th hour here to have this completely different model put forward that the CJC is not proposing to you. You have a proposal in front of you that was voted on, and you have all the votes and you have all the understanding of the disagreements that occurred and where there's a majority and why, that what you should be voting on is the CJC's proposal and the question of are there specific provisions like the ones we're talking about now on standard of conduct, standard of evidence that you may agree or disagree with, but not a question of should there be a completely different model that's put in front of you. This is the first time I'm actually seeing this proposal that was in front of the SA. It seems to me the question is, did the SA disagree with another constituent body being the UA? But I don't know how you interpret this, but this seems to be just really a last minute kind of thing to change the total model that the CJC has given you.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to Barbara and then to you, Logan. That's okay. Barbara.
Sorry, thank you very much. I suppose I'm hearing that a number of us in this meeting today have felt some personal tweaks or tweaks on behalf of our offices. I just want to assure everybody here that if anybody thinks that the OJA's office is in the business that we're in, has chosen the career path that people have chosen to do this work because they want to prosecute innocent students, that is something that I would beg you to reconsider. That is not why any of us choose to do this work. I want to address the preponderance standard, and I think the question that Caroline Levine asked is really, it gets at the heart of it from my perspective. I believe preponderance is the best standard because it best balances, we are a campus community. The preponderance standard best balances the interests of complainants, respondents, and the campus community. And it says it is not a fly-by-night standard that's loosey-goosey. It is the standard that is applied in every civil lawsuit. It applies not just in contract claims and real estate. It applies in torts and assaults, and not necessarily a criminal assault, but it applies in other types of, you know, interpersonal conflicts that people have. It's not a fly-by-night thing. And we have actually assaults on our campus that are not sexual assaults. And so when you have, those are types of interpersonal issues. And I will just say, to me, it's about trying to strike the balance and find fairness in our community. And I don't think you can say that a preponderance standard, that the clear and convincing standard by definition tilts the field in favor of those who are accused. And I get that there are really serious consequences that can happen to people who are accused under our campus code of conduct. But if you replay some of the comments that have been made, the concern again and again by those who favor clear and convincing is out of interest for how the respondents will be treated in this process. And I think we should trust people in our campus community to weigh all of the interests, complainants, respondents, and the campus community as a whole. And I believe that's what a preponderance standard does better than clear and convincing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. Logan.
Yeah, I just wanted to note that I was gonna just agree with Teresa that any new proposals, I think at this point, since we're so late in the game and we have to vote, should have probably gone through the CJC ahead of time, because it's really hard for all of us to read the documents we already have from the CJC. And it, whether it would have been to be put on a public forum or whether it would have been put in box, I just think that would have been the more appropriate forum, but primarily to have gone to the CJC. It is concerning that the CJC hasn't heard of that. And then just to quickly respond to Barbara, because one of my potential avenues in life is to be a progressive prosecutor, whether it's at the Philadelphia DA's office or somewhere else that believes in progressive prosecution and restorative justice. I just think that lowering the burden of proof makes it easier to find someone responsible. I think it's clear enough to find that just by the 51%. And then that clear and convincing is our way to restorative justice, because it gives everyone a fair chance in our system. Thank you.
Joe.
Yeah, so I think on the procedural point, when I read the essay's charter, you know, to address Reese's point, I interpreted pretty broadly of an assembly's action, that being, you know, the CJC submitting its version of, you know, the code to the UA. So that's just how I interpreted it. I'm happy to say that, you know, if someone disagrees with that interpretation in the moment, you know, like, you know, it is kind of just like how it is, I suppose. And, you know, it could be considered a mistake. It could not be considered a mistake. I don't know. It's, you know, these are things that are open to interpretation. So I just want to, you know, say that first and foremost, you know, this was, again, me in the sense of trying to figure out what the best kind of chain of action was. And I'm happy to say, you know, if people disagree with how I do it, then I think, you know, I'll happily own that and say, you know, say I'm sorry, ask for forgiveness if people want me to, if that's something that people are so, you know, concerned about. I just want to assuage any potential concern in that regard, because I don't want to come off and seem like if we're sliding home under something, because that's just not the intention, I think, of when I was interpreting it. And so I think that's it. And I think that, you know, with this whole entire process, it is emotional. It is important to consider these things. But again, we are considering, and I tried to encourage people to consider the broad scope of the change in system that is in the CJC's version. It is not just one component. It is a large set of components. These procedures are not just one thing. It is a large set of procedures that someone might go through. I mean, we have written in, and I think it's important to point out, a full investigative process that has not been present in previous codes in an official codified manner. There is a wide range present to you there, and I think that needs to be considered by UA members. So yes, while we focus on standard of proof, there is so much more to start to consider within inside of these conversations. And I want to encourage that, because if we just wanted to have a conversation of standard of proof, they would have made CJC's work a lot easier. We could have just typed that little paragraph up and went for it. We have not even touched potential concerns around the substantive part of the code of conduct. We have not, I want to encourage people, you know, we have time between this meeting and next week. You know, that needs to be considered by this group, because we're not just voting on one small piece, we're voting on a massive overhaul to a massive system. And I think it's important to recognize the work that has been put into that. So that's kind of, I hope, the comment that can, that people kind of leave this with. I mean, it's been an emotionally charged meeting and pre-meeting and everything like that, which is natural. I mean, this is a big moment for a lot of us that we're nearing the end, but I think I really encourage people to look through more and kind of see what the full system offers.
It is 6 o'clock. There are a couple of hands up. I think, I know some people need to leave at six, and I think it's probably best to adjourn on time. Joe has summed up, I think, where we need to be next time around. People should go and carefully read through this. We have some monumental amount of work that's been done, really to make a final consensus next week. And so
just extend the meeting by like 3 minutes just to propose my Good Samaritan language, which is on the agenda and was attached, just to introduce it to the group.
If there's a second and we don't lose quorum, which we may.
Second.
All those in favor of extending the meeting for 3 minutes? Check your little yes boxes there. I can't count them. Is Pilar still there?
No.
No, Pilar needed to sign off. Sorry. Can someone count? I'm not able to count from where I am.
1, 2, 3.
Jeff, can you count?
12.
12? Okay,
Chris,
3 minutes.
To it.
Okay.
So if everyone had a chance to look at it, the main reason that I'm bringing it forward is because currently within our system, if we have a student who calls the police and asks for an ambulance on behalf of an intoxicated or student under the influence of drugs who's in dire risk and they're taken, campus police can search their items, their personal belongings, and we're charging them under the code for false identification if they have a false ID, which I think is in stark contrast to everything that the Good Samaritan law stands for. So I don't know if it's very different from what we have currently. And I know that New York State has codified this for criminal purposes. And I know that we're not following New York State criminal procedure, but I figured I'd share that. But the main thing that I wanted to bring to everyone's attention was that I'd like to see a code where students who are in risk of potentially dying they don't have their friends afraid to call for help because they're fearing that their friends could get in trouble because we've previously charged them with having false identification in the past. So just to have that be in the code that they wouldn't be charged for something like false identification doesn't preclude them from being charged from other things, like including having drugs or selling drugs, harassment. I just wanted to introduce that to everyone because I think that it's something that we should strongly consider adding in to the code.
Okay, thank you. With that, I think we really are out of time. People need to leave. I think we accomplished a lot. There's some heat, but let's move on. I don't think, as I say, everyone I think has the best interests of the university in mind. Let's keep that in mind and figure out how to best serve that. So thank you. Stay safe until our next meeting. We are adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.